This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to the New Books Network for New Books and Military History. I am Boris Karp, and I have here today Charlotte Manson, who is the former chief historian for the Marine Corps, and he has written a book titled Fighting for Time, Rhodesia's Military and Zimbabwe's Independence. Welcome to our show, Charles.
Glad to be here.
Now, there have been many books written about this subject, and yours is, of course, I've read it, and I think it's a very important contribution, but I'd like you to explain this to our listeners who might not have read the book. A lot of books have been written prior about the Rhodesian conflict. It's been subject to some public interest. And perhaps you could explain to us why you have chosen this particular subject. Why are we returning to Rhodesia now?
Well, one reason is that it has been some time in the past, and there has been amount of serious reporting and academic literature on the conflict, particularly on the relations between the United Kingdom and Southern Rhodesia, which was one of their colonies. And in the course of this, the military literature tended to be maybe overly dramatic or focused on more of the sensational aspects and really hadn't received any serious study as a military or operational history. So that was the gap in the literature that I was attempting to fill.
So what we have here before our readers is a book which in some extent is deeper in its inquiry of what happened, rather than many books which we have seen which are more oriented to the general public, which have a lot of discussion of how the Rhodesian soldiers fought, what uniforms they wore, or what helicopters they used. But what we have here is a much deeper inquiry.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, a number of the military memoirs and articles, while significant in themselves as coming from a participant, really focused on some of the superficial aspects without giving any of the background or context behind the military actions. And then a lot of them take place at such a small or lower level that it's information that's very perishable and ephemeral. So I was hoping to give some context to these memoirs.
Thank you. Now, there's a question which we ask, which is traditional for the show, and I think it's an important question to the people in our audience who are considering becoming writers or who are working on their own books, which we often have among our audience. And the question is, when you were working on this book, what is the most serious obstacle which you faced, and how did you overcome this obstacle?
I think with writing any military history, you would hope to have a good storyline, you know, a dramatic storyline where the two sides are in highlight and in opposition to each other. You also hope to have participants available that you can query or interact with that took place in the conflict, but maybe have had some time to reconcile their experience with their views later in life. And the biggest obstacle to the Rhodesian conflict for a historian was the availability of records and documentation that are kind of necessary to provide the foundation of any account, because there was just no central archive to go to. A lot of the military and police records left the country for South Africa, or they were actually destroyed at the end of the conflict. And there, again, was no central repository to have access to. And frankly, when I started work on this, it was too soon after the conflict to do this. Journalists, by their nature, are working without these same sources, and at times their work can be fairly questionable. You know, it may be dramatic and immediate, but it isn't necessarily based on official information.
And how have you managed, you know, I always ask people how you have overcome your obstacle, because obviously you have overcome the obstacle. We have a book. We're discussing the results of your success on this show. So can you tell us how you dealt with these problems?
That's a good one, too. As time goes by, or as time went by, the British government made their material available following pretty much what they call a 30-year rule, which is that official documentation will be available to the public 30 years after the event. There was also the efforts of the Rhodesian Army Association, both in South Africa and in the United Kingdom, to make their material available in an archive. Now, that archive has since been shut down, but I was able to access it and use its material. And most of my research material resides with the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in Chicago.
I would like to thank you personally for saying these things, because I do some of my own research, and some of this is things which I did not know about, and this will come in useful not just to our listeners, some of whom, again, are writers and researchers, but also to me personally. Thank you, sir. One thing I'd also like to ask, and it's a bit of I'm going to struggle wording this question properly. Now, one thing which you discuss in your book is that Rhodesian leadership originally did not want to, or perhaps they were not able to, recognize what was the full meaning of what was happening in their country, and at first they did not want to accept that they were at war, and they attempted to use police measures to deal with it. Now, we obviously know today that this was not a correct assessment. Obviously, this was a war which they then proceeded to lose. But here is my question. In the context of their time, in the context of the intelligence information and the other information which they had actually available to them at the time, do you think that it was a reasonable decision for them to make within their context? Or was this, you know, absolutely, you know, or was this unhinged?
I think you would have to put yourself in the minds of the Rhodesian political leadership, which had wanted a goal that was probably unattainable of securing independence on the basis of minority rule, and it, which was basically European or white rule of an African and black country, and that they were seeking this through the international community, but primarily with the United Kingdom, which was the power responsible for them. So by either dampening or choosing to minimize any internal conflict, they were trying to present the picture of normality to the United Kingdom and to the outside world. And the Rhodesian police force was a very large and well-established institution. It was, in fact, probably bigger than their Air Force and Army combined. And it had traditionally been the keeper of law and order and also had provided for the external defense of the country, at least through the Second World War. So there was a couple of institutional structures that provided resistance to declaring it an open conflict and anything more than a struggle against what they viewed as criminal or illegal terrorism, and that this could be handled by their traditional methods, traditional colonial methods.
So, to some extent, if I understand you correctly, on one hand, they did to some extent understand that they were deceiving other people to what was happening, and on the other hand, they had a great institutional interest and interpreting this within the context of the core competencies, the capabilities which they already had.
Yes, I mean, that's true. And you have to keep in mind that the period after World War II saw rapid decolonization in Africa, in southern or sub-Saharan Africa, and that these conflicts were regional in that they, you know, stretched from Namibia through to Botswana and Zambia and into Mozambique. And Rhodesia found itself as part of, you know, the opposition to what were called the frontline states. As these countries gained their independence from the colonial powers, the Rhodesians were put in a position of really fighting against the tide of history for their independence under minority rule.
Sir, this allows me to go on to our next question, which I think to some extent is connected directly to what you've just explained to us. Now, an inescapable issue in the discussion of this conflict is, of course, the issue of race. There was one group which wanted to have a state of inequity, a state of where, you know, they were in charge over a much greater group of people based on their race. And of course there were some some African Rhodesians who were fighting in the armed forces on behalf of minority rule. We have an extended record of this existing, but largely the story is a story of minority rule and the story of course, racism, the perception of one group of people as being sorely different from whites, you know, not fully, I would even say, perceived as inferior in some way. Now, I want to ask, did the Rhodesian whites view of their opponents as being racial inferiors, the stereotypes which they held, which are very evident if you read the memoirs of some of the people who fought in this war, did these stereotypes, did these racial beliefs affect their military planning? Did it shape their decision-making on a lower level in a way which handicapped them?
Well, the issue of racism is tied into the broader issue of colonial history in Africa. And the issue of race in Rhodesia has been the topic, particularly of academic scholars. So my comments, I think, as your questions indicate, we're looking at it in terms of its military impact. And I think part of the situation here was the fairly professional and trained Rhodesian army was having to fight guerrillas who ranged from being equally well-trained to, you know, what would be called a seven-day wonder, where they basically gave somebody some political indoctrination, a weapon, and sent them, you know, into the country to create the situation of insecurity and kind of classic guerrilla warfare of being everywhere and being nowhere. But the individual guerrilla was not considered much of a fighter by the Rhodesians. And I'm sure this in part was based on inherent feeling of racial superiority. And in fact, in the colonial circumstances where any European was seen to be above any of a local in terms of status, it another byproduct of the colonial heritage or background. And they also had, you know, a kind of a formal hierarchy in the country of your white British or, you know, United Kingdom immigrants, your South African European immigrants, East Indian Asian immigrants, the group they called colored, which were the mixed race residents of the colony. It wasn't quite as formal as apartheid in South Africa, but it was very much informal reality. And it was a bone of contention. I think you also have to consider a large portion of the African population was what they labeled as tribal. And these lived in the rural areas and in reserves and were engaged in subsistence farming. This was the area where the education was primarily conducted via different religious missionaries. And this was an area where the British South Africa police, which is neither British nor South African, provided pretty much the essential services of government through the internal affairs or what used to be known as the Native Department. So there was cultural differences, there were racial differences, there are definitely economic differences, and really all these were problems that the established government didn't solve. And I suspect you could almost say today they still haven't been solved.
And one thing which I found somewhat jarring to me as a, you know, of course, I am a reader from a different period of time. When I read about these events from the testimony of Rhodesian soldiers, the white Rhodesian soldiers, and they talk about the African fighters or African soldiers which they fight, and they accuse them of having all sorts of vices. They talk about the drug use, for example, among these guerrilla fighters. And they talk about this as an element of these people being so bad, so, you know, uncivilized. And then often in the same testimony, they will tell us about similar vices being encountered among the Rhodesian soldiers.
When I talked about
and of course they are far more forgiving when they talk about these vices among their own men.
Right. And keep in mind, when I was talking about a tribal background, I wasn't trying to be purgative about it. It just that the rural population was a subsistence group and didn't have the advantages of education, welfare, although they were, you know, like I say, fairly well taken care of by African standards. The vices, I suspect, are on par with each other.
Maybe you could clarify this a bit for our listeners. As I understand from what you're saying, is that there was also a gradation in terms of culture and social status among the African population of what they had access to or how they have been educated and brought up. None of them were as well off as whites, but there were different groups which were also very different from each other. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, there was a developing black middle class. These primarily were in religious fields, labor leadership. They had education. They had a degree of wealth, and these would have been the developing middle class that you looked upon to get your government and social and military leaders and workers from. There was a large African component in the police force, and there was a large African component in the Rhodesian military. But again, they weren't put in a position where they could use any authority over a person of European descent. So there was a change or a society that had developed, but it certainly hadn't developed with any speed. And I think the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, Ian Smith, once said that they wouldn't be in that position for 1,000 years, which kind of shows the rate of progress that was anticipated.
Okay, so I'm going to move on to our next question. One thing that a lot of books on this subject talk about is the operations of the special police. And a lot of their actions during the war were covert actions. Some of them you talk about in your books, such as the pseudo-gang activities, which were similar to what many other colonial authorities did in other countries, where they, of course, infiltrated the movements through forming their own fake guerrilla cells. And other things were somewhat, I want to say unorthodox, although obviously these are things which have been done throughout the entire history of war, where we will read about them planting poison clothing for the guerrillas to find, which was coated in neurotoxins, or booby-trapped equipment, or consumer goods which were booby-trapped. Radios were popular for this. And did these actions have any effect? Did they demoralize the guerrillas in any way, or did they just, you know, make them angrier?
The Rhodesian police And it was also the source of the Central Intelligence Organization, which was their external intelligence system. Had a lock on intelligence and what you might call special activities. Internally, they had a special branch, which was supposed to counter subversion. The Army and the Air Force had their own intelligence corps, although they dealt mainly with conventional military type intelligence. But they had a interest in dirty tricks, which seems to derive from a colonial context. But I think if you look into conventional forces, they also use dirty tricks, and it covered a range of activities, some of which were successful, like the pseudo operations, some of which were not successful or were merely, the odd poisoning clothing and material had a harassing factor. It was supposed to bring about a sense of insecurity, but moving over to chemical weapons, it was found that really wasn't controllable and you know, was as much a threat to the Rhodesian forces as the Zimbabwe guerrillas. They engaged in assassination of political leaders overseas. These are things that, escaped legality and morality. I always find it interesting that it's the keepers of law and order, the police, that involved themselves in this sort of thing. So there was an intelligence conflict that went on that kind of parallels the military conflict. Although I thought it was interesting that Ken Flowers, who was a former Rhodesian policeman and then the head of the Central Intelligence Organization, went on to remain with the Robert Mugabe government after independence, at least for a time. How effective it was, I would hesitate to guess because it's really hard to measure. Like I say, the pseudo operations in terms of gathering intelligence and information was very successful. Some of the more bizarre things like the poisoning and chemical weapons, the use of tracking dogs in this weren't as successful. One of their kind of unsung intelligence highlights was their air photography and mapping capability, which put them in a position to be able to control terrain and population and locations, which you don't really hear much about.
And of course, in modern counterintelligence warfare, air photography plays a vast role. We read about it a lot.
Right. And they had, electronic intelligence, electronic warfare capability as well.
These are things which I think are omitted from many of the conventional accounts of the war. And so, which brings me to another question which interests me because I am conducting this interview from Israel, and the topic of counterinsurgency warfare comes up in this country a lot. And so one thing which I often read about in military theory discussion is the idea that a counterinsurgent force can be in a way too successful. And what I mean is, do you think it is true to some extent that the fact that the Rhodesian armed forces, and especially the ones which we hear about a lot, like the Rhodesian Light Infantry and Fire Force and the Silas scouts, is it possible that because they were so good at achieving tactical success and, you know, beating the guerrillas in these and these fights and battles, did it in a sense contribute to the self-deception of the Rhodesian leadership that they could in a way win? Would they have been more willing to have some kind of settlement or compromise if they had felt they were not doing as well in the military sense? Was it in some way a self-sabotage?
That's a good question and is a key point. The political leaders and the police leaders felt they were on top of the situation through the first part of the 1970s, 1972. This was the time when the adjacent Portuguese colonies of Mozambique had lost their struggle against their own insurgency, and to some extent the two insurgencies in Rhodesia and Mozambique merged. And the guerrillas, no matter how poorly trained, were infiltrating the countries in large numbers. The Selous Scouts initiative allowed these infiltrating guerrillas to be located or anticipated, and this allowed the light infantry and eventually the African Rifles to respond with helicopter reaction forces. And you basically had a squad leaders war going on where the Rhodesian air mobility and airborne firepower was used to eliminate, destroy the infiltrating guerrillas. But even so, the guerrilla infiltration spread throughout the country and was continuous. And the end result was, no matter how successful the Rhodesians were internally, it didn't stop the influx of guerrillas that were coming in from outside of the country. And in order to do that, they escalated in the mid-1970s to cross-border operations, external raids that would target the guerrilla base camps and training facilities and population centers. Eventually, the external operations were more successful in terms of numbers killed than the internal operations. But eventually, by the late 70s, they had to target the infrastructure in the surrounding frontline countries, primarily Zambia and Mozambique. And when I say infrastructure, it would be the roads, the rails, the bridges, power stations, communication sites. And they eventually would go after targeted efforts to eliminate the guerrilla leadership. This was successful to a point. But by the time of the Lancaster House initiative, the numbers overwhelmed the Rhodesian ability to respond to them militarily. And the only thing the military could really do is slow things down and put pressure on the civilian leadership to come up with a negotiated settlement. And maybe one of the lessons that was needed to be learned is that if you kill off your enemy leadership, you're left with no one to negotiate with, or you're left to negotiate with the leadership that's maybe more fanatical or less inclined to negotiate. So that by 1979, the country really had to have a negotiated settlement. And then that brought about the internal contradictions with the guerrillas, where you had their own racial divisions between the minority Matabele and the majority Mashona groupings that had a civil war after the independence.
Thank you. Now, there's a question which often comes up in the military history discussions, and it's really something which is a subject of a lot of interest in both in the military theory circles and in the military history community, the idea of how military organizations learn, how they have their experience informs their future actions, how they learn from successes and failures. And so I would like to ask you about the concept of learning within the Rhodesian security forces. Where is there an organization which was capable of learning? Was it called a learning organization, or were they people who were, as we sometimes say, stuck on stupid? Did they have the ability to learn and adapt tactically, operationally, doctrinally from their experience?
That's, again, another good question, and I would have to answer it with a yes and a no. The Rhodesian military had served outside of the colony in some of the other British colonial conflicts, in Malaya, in Suez Canal Zone, in Aden, in Kenya, and they took the lessons from these local conflicts and applied them to their own situation. Some of this was formal. Some of this was informal. They had come up with their own doctrine and regulations. But a lot of it was improvised. And one of the main lessons they didn't really learn was the importance of civil affairs and civic action, that the type of conflict they were involved in would be won or lost among the population, and that they had to get the population on side through either population and resources control or psychological action. And the Rhodesian military and the Rhodesian government had allocated this to the Department of Internal Affairs, and they never really put the resources to developing an effective civil affairs, civil action program. They felt that the colonial approach had worked in the past and would continue to work in the future. And I think there was a question of at what point did they realize their strategic goal, independence under minority rule, was really a workable strategic goal. Related to this was their relationship with South Africa, and South Africa position was they were more than happy to resist the frontline states as long as Mozambique and Rhodesia and Namibia were able to provide a buffer zone. Once they were no longer able to provide an effective buffer zone from the nationalists to the north, the South Africans withdrew their support, and they, in effect, used their control of supplies and resources, including oil, to force the Rhodesians to come to a negotiated solution. So on one hand, the Rhodesian Army was a learning organization. On the other hand, they might have learned the wrong lessons. They certainly weren't overly doctrinaire. It was more informal lessons learned at the tactics, techniques, and procedural level.
Thank you. That's actually quite enlightening. And I hope it's as enlightening to our listeners as it is to me. Now, as a conclusion to this talk, I'd like to come back to something which is, again, tradition is a big thing on this show, as you have probably already gathered. Tradition is a thing for us. And there's a traditional closing question, you know, because this is a show, you know, by and for, much like the Senate is by the people and for the people, we have here a show which is by readers and writers and for readers and writers. And in this context, I'd like it if you could perhaps talk about which books you are reading right now, or otherwise books which you could suggest to our audience. What is your current book queue, perhaps? What is your stage in your book journey?
What I would recommend, I've got a very exhaustive bibliography in Fighting for Time, which kind of indicates the material I went through on Rhodesia. So I would commend that to anyone who wanted to follow up. My personal reading is I'm revisiting a memoir by Fitzroy MacLean called Eastern Approaches. And it's his travels through the former Soviet Union and through the Mideast and in the Southeast Europe or the Balkans during the Second World War. As kind of a revisited to a well-written memoir that also deals with the issues of societies in flux and in insurgencies, being the British military mission representative to Tito and having experience with the special air service in North Africa and with the British embassy in Moscow prior to the war.
Yep. Mr. Nelson, I would like to first of all wish you and, of course, our audience a happy new year. We are recording this on the first day of 2022, so happy new year to both you and our listeners. And I would like to thank you for being with us today.
I enjoyed being here. I enjoyed talking about the book, which was written over a period of time. And I think, like all histories, you need time for the events to provide primary and secondary sources that lets the historian dig into it.
Sir, I again thank you for being with us today, and thank you. I'd like to thank our listeners for listening to our show today. This was Boris Scarpa and Charles Melson at the New Books Network. Thank you all.